नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि. In investigating anicca, impermanence, it's important to investigate it in its details of just reflecting on what is the beginning, and just to note in this how things that arise inside of thought or feeling, how things. Or something comes up, it begins, and then it reaches its peak and it ends. Or you can contemplate the nature of endings, death, endings, cessation. Birth and the beginning, isn't it? Birth, a physical birth, but then mental states begin, and we can't remember our birth, physical birth, and usually we aren't aware of how things arise until they've arisen in the mind. So that's why when we contemplate, when we reflect on what has arisen in our consciousness, if there's suffering, if we're suffering in some way, we're attached to something. So that which has arisen, we contemplate the mood, the feeling, the atmosphere, whatever way we're feeling or experiencing life is in the conscious moment. Then we have the opportunity to see it cease, to be with its passing. And this is like our lifetime, isn't it? We're now, say, we're alive, breathing, physically breathing, conscious beings, but we're all going to die in the future. So we're on the arising, and we're now on, many of us are on the downhill slide. But we can say it's like this. We can we see it as we're contemplating the nature of, say, of aging, watching the aging process take place, or the one sees that it's just the body that gets old. The mind doesn't get old. And sometimes young people don't realize that old people, bodies are old, but sometimes their minds are still young. Sometimes their minds are too young, they're still 14-year-olds or whatever. My grandmother died at 75, but emotionally she was about 16 years old. Still boy crazy at 75. Now notice when that which has arisen, we're like just this experience of consciousness. We're in a conscious form now, so we don't need to find a definition for consciousness in the dictionary. Because we're actually experiencing consciousness. It's like this. And this is like a reflection on consciousness, on vijnana. It's this way. It's not, you don't have to find out a definition for it or what so-and-so says consciousness is, because you're already conscious. And it's this way. It's like trying to find out what the taste of honey is by reading a definition of it. And find out what other people say about it, when all you have to do is taste it for yourself, and you know. So consciousness is this subject-object experience. It means a separate form, isn't it? We're born in a human body. That means now we're conscious. There's a in the universe we're a form that lives in this universe that's conscious within this particular as a subjective experience. We're experiencing the universe in a subjective way. Because how it impinges on this form, how it hits us, how it affects us. So consciousness is the natural experience of the subject to object. And we're the subject of our whole lifetime, aren't we? Each one of us is the subject. And trying to see the difference between being a personality and being a subject. I mean, our experience is subjective because that's just the way it is. We experience life from where we are. You know, what hits us, what contacts us, that we experience, that affects us. And so consciousness is, say, if I hold this clock up, into, you know, say, eye consciousness through the eye. One is conscious of it, there's consciousness of it as an object of sight. And then, but then we can also see that we perceive it as a clock. So consciousness is, it doesn't necessarily mean there's perception operating. It means that what comes into the field of the sense organs impinges on them, that we are conscious of. Then we have this ability to perceive things, to name things, to think and remember and put and have logic and reason, rational thinking and so forth. So these are tools of the mind, but these are instilled in the mind through education, through culture. But when we're born, we aren't born with with perceptions already instilled in us. We're born as a conscious being and a feeling. We have feeling and consciousness in the body. So this is to point out the way it is, so we can begin to see what is culturally acquired. We each acquire the perceptions, the prejudices, the values of our particular families and class, ethnic background, religious background. That's instilled in us after we're born. We aren't born with that. So what I'm doing is laying a foundation of just the way things are that is non-personal, non-cultural, just in terms of Dhamma. This is consciousness is Dhamma and feeling and the body. It's just the way it is. Then we're conditioned through the values, the biases, the prejudices, the attitudes of our mother, father, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, grandparents, the class that we're born into, the nationality, where the identities with femininity, masculinity, all these things are instilled in the mind. So when we get that perspective clear, then we can see we're re-educating ourselves in to see things in the way that's in line with truth, in alignment with truth, rather than just the random conditioning of, or the haphazard conditioning of culture and attitudes and prejudices and biases that you get stuck with because you happen to be born in that particular family, in that particular situation. The personality, the sense of oneself as being the body, as being a male or female, as being a certain type, as being good or bad, or whatever. These are attitudes that are instilled into the mind after birth. So they're based on you acquire them just through the experience of life, what you get, what your parents give you, what the fears and the problems of the age that you're born in, or the group that you live with. So these, then, in terms of reflective meditation, we're contemplating them as anicca, as what arises ceases, and as non-self. So it's a way of looking at even the most personal kind of feelings or attitudes or the most kind of emotional fraught situations that you have, and a way of looking at them as in terms of Dhamma, as they really are, rather than as what you feel they are, what you think they are, what you believe they are. So this way you can look at things that you oftentimes have never dared to look at when you know how to look at them, because you know, oftentimes we're afraid to look at things, or we're afraid to know too much, or afraid to look too deeply, or to admit certain things, because we know we interpret it always in a very personal way, which can be very cause us a lot of suffering. If we happen to interpret our life's experiences and our karmic collections on the personal level, you can come up with some pretty dismal conclusions about yourself. And also, many of us tend to exaggerate the bad side of life. How many of you spend more time thinking about all your faults and failures than about your virtues and your goodness? How many of you spend any time thinking about your own goodness? Do you ever think about that? Or here in Britain, I think British people would think that would be unseemly. Because it's like boasting or something, admitting that you're good would be bragging about yourself. But in terms of what the Buddha recommended is to bring into your consciousness your own goodness, not as a kind of false ego trip of saying I'm good, I'm wonderful. It's not that. It's recognizing through our own ability to reflect on the goodness that we have, which is not easy, because most of us, I think, are more aware of our faults, and they tend to be exaggerated. A fault can just be taken out of a context and just obsess your mind, and the good things which you can just dismiss. You can say, oh, it doesn't matter, but look at this. So I think it's very important that we recollect, we bring into consciousness the goodness of our lives, the good things that we do, our intentions, the generosity, the kindness, the love that we feel for things. Why are you here at this meditation retreat anyway? Because you're good, isn't it? Basically, you want to know the truth. Because you aspire to spiritual realization. And this is none of you are here, I think, to cause any harm or to steal things from the retreat center or to persecute each other or anything like that. We're all here out of the basic goodness we all share. We contemplate this and begin to admit, the virtuousness of your life, not to convince yourself, but be honest. What is, the way we don't like to see others harmed. We don't appreciate life when the brutality and the unfairness of it. And we love to hear about good things and virtuous people. The Dalai Lama now is a kind of international hero, because people are starved for virtuous leaders. We don't have them. Or we don't tend to see them as virtuous. We tend to be critical of them. And that we like we want to tear them down, kind of exaggerate their faults and even destroy them. It's amazing when after President Clinton was elected, the Americans proceeded to, in a most kind of nasty way, trying to destroy him. Couldn't do anything right. And of course, if you're president of the United States, everybody's looking at you all the time. Must be even hard to, the only place you get any privacy is in the toilet. Then they have that probably bugged or something. So, and the Dalai Lama is worthy, isn't it? He's obviously a very worthy human being. So, but we long to have Dalai Lamas, exemplary human beings. And when the Dalai Lama was here this year, it was talks in the Wembley Conference Center were extremely well attended. People weren't necessarily, I'm sure most of the people weren't even Buddhist. They were just people, the loving, the truth and virtuousness and goodness in somebody else, wanting to be near them, wanting to witness them. Sometimes we take a very jaundiced and distorted view of humanity. It's like the way we talk about human beings are just, if you give them enough money, they'll do anything you want, kind of philosophy. Or you can buy anyone, if you give them, you have money. Or you can, everybody has their price. Everybody is just selfish and thinking of themselves. So get what you can for yourself, don't worry about the rest. These kind of cynical and negative philosophies about humanity. And we can see there are certain grounds to think that, not that is totally untrue. Because we can be like that. We can be just self-centered, selfish people that just trying to get what we can for ourselves. Admittedly, that is possible for us. But that isn't the image we need to encourage in people's consciousness. We need to recognize the potential of humanity, the goodness of it, the opportunity human beings have for realization, the miracle of our humanity. When we start contemplating it, our humanity in this way, then we begin to appreciate and value our lives and each other in a way we don't when we just look at each other in these cynical terms, or dwelling on what's wrong with everyone, what's wrong with oneself. Now, one skillful means that we have for dealing with negativity is metta practice. And metta is, for those of you who don't know what it means loving kindness. And it's an attitude of mind, really, that one develops. And metta especially is useful practice in a society where we tend to dwell on what's wrong with ourselves and the world. For example, when I first came to live in England in 1977, lived in London, one could feel it that one was living in a society that was quite negative and critical. Having lived in Thailand for over a decade, it's a different feeling, different atmosphere. In Thailand, the people aren't so negative or critical. A lot more kind of faith in the Dhamma, and especially in the part of Thailand that I live in, the Northeast, there was a lot more kind of positive feeling amongst the people themselves generally speaking. But here in Britain, in England, for example, it's the people are tend to be critical by nature. We tend to think and see, complain or see what's wrong with things. This tends to dominate oftentimes how we see things. We see what's wrong with something, and that includes ourselves. We tend to exaggerate the weakness of the flaw. So metta is a very useful means, skillful means, to deal with this problem of say self-disparagement or emphasizing the faults or the things that are wrong with oneself or with others or with the society. Because metta is non-aversion, basically. It's metta is the ability to accept something for what it is without and not creating aversion or hatred or negativity, not following it with negativity. So that metta doesn't mean liking something or loving something in a way that you want it to be with you, or that you it's not a kind of, it's not meant to be a synonym to liking something. But when we talk about love in this sense, it's more the underlying acceptance of things and not dwelling in aversion or not following it with a lot of criticisms. So metta at first, when we first start towards oneself, we're developing that sense of not dwelling on what's wrong with ourselves. Not kind of thinking this isn't right and I'm not good at this and going through the whole list of our faults. But it's being more patient and accepting of our weaknesses or what's wrong with us, without hating ourselves or criticizing ourselves for being this way. So one can look at metta in this way. Sometimes it's often taught in a way that some people find it very difficult, because they say, may I be well, may I be happy, and it sounds, to a critical person, it sounds silly. It sounds like, very superficial and not very sincere or realistic. One feels a bit cynical towards it, or a bit averse to just the may I be well, may I be happy type of metta practice. But remember that the metta, that's just That particular phrase, may I be well, may I be happy, may I be free from suffering, is not meant to be just a sentiment you're kind of projecting onto yourself, but you are developing an attitude of kindness and acceptance towards the body you have, and towards the negativity or the fears or the desires that you might have, meaning that you're not going to hate them or despise them or want to complicate your life by dwelling and by becoming obsessed with what's wrong. So metta is like being able to accept in a kind and patient way what maybe you've never accepted or never allowed or always resisted or fought against or rebelled. So I would apply this when I first started doing metta practice in Thailand. I started using this as a way of just dealing with the tendency to be self-critical. And I just practiced my metta of being just accepting my own limitations and the weaknesses, not justifying them not a justification of weakness, but it's not making a problem about things, not creating a negative attitude towards yourself because of weaknesses or faults that you do have. It doesn't mean you aren't aware of them or you're trying to say you don't have any. It's not that. It's not faults. You're not trying to delude yourself, fool yourself. But it is an attitude of patient acceptance, of kindness with what you don't like or don't want, especially. Now, it's easy to have loving kindness towards what you like, isn't that it? It's like, you know, the little puppies and kittens, and not hard to generate metta towards these, or pleasing people that are pleasant and attractive and pleasing and polite and good manners and not disruptive. It's not difficult to generate loving kindness towards those. But where we fail, isn't it, is in the way we can be averse towards those beings that we don't like, or that are unlikable, or do things that are unlikable, or that are mean-hearted, or that are unkind. So we can become very, you know, you can see in one's own life how, you know, if you see somebody who you know is going to cause you trouble, you just want to get rid of them. You want to shut them out. Get away. I don't want any trouble. Or how we can become very cruel to people because we think of, if they hurt our feelings or they offend us in any way or they threaten us in any way, we can just want to kind of kick them out, throw them away, get out of here. Because they bring up anger or fear in us. So practicing metta, we develop this attitude of patient kindness, acceptance of even the anger we're feeling, or the fear, or the jealousy, or the resentments, or the bitterness that we're feeling. Towards these mental states means that we're accepting them for what they are, rather than hating them and hating ourselves for having them. And the more we do this with ourselves, the more we begin to be able to relate to others in the same way. I think being a monk is a really fortunate thing to be, because you're living in a community where you don't have all that much choice about who you're going to live with. You can't just say, I want only these monks and nuns that I like here, and the rest can go. Anyone who's willing to become a monk or nun, you accept. You know, they're willing to keep the precepts, and it doesn't mean that you like them all. It means that if they're willing to live in this way, then you let them do that. So you find yourself living in a community with people that you wouldn't live with if you had a choice. Some of them. But this also is, I think, very helpful in growing up, because one learns how to open out more widely to others, to idiosyncrasies, to eccentricities, to personalities and people that one would never have bothered with, or one would not have given anyone's time to, if you were just following your own personal immature habits. You'd had it when I was a layman. I could kind of choose who I wanted to associate with, who I wanted to be with, and you had all ways of kind of avoiding all the rest. You could kind of control it to a certain degree. But as a monk in a Buddhist monastery, this is not the case. But it's good fortune that it's not the case, because when you get beyond your own personal reactions, emotional reactions to individuals and to personalities, and you find many qualities in people that you would have never noticed, and you begin to even like people that before you didn't even you dislike, or you begin to understand the people that before you didn't understand, because when you're living together, you have to, this metta practice allows us to accept each other, allows us to, keeps reminding us that we aren't the God who's going to choose who's going to be enlightened and who isn't, and who deserves to live in the monastery and who doesn't, or who's a good monk and who isn't. That we watch this in ourselves, our own kind of emotional tendencies towards liking and disliking the monks, the nuns, the novices, the lay people that one shares one's life with. Now, the metta towards oneself, it's like, ask yourself, do you really love yourself? And I'm sure some of you, if I asked you that question right now, you wouldn't know what to say. I think it'd be embarrassing to say, yes, I do. And then, because it sounds like it sounds egotistical. But this is what I call silent listening. I developed a technique of listening to my mind. So when I would ask myself about if I loved myself, then there'd be a certain kind of reaction to that. Kind of, at first I'd use this phrase, like what they do in California, I'd say, I love you, to myself. And then I didn't like that either. So I'd watch this reaction this emotional reaction. It's a conditioned reaction of being averse to that, to saying that to myself. And I have metta for that reaction. I would accept the reaction. I'd notice it, but I wouldn't like or dislike. I wouldn't allow myself to make anything out of it. I just accept the reaction and observe it. And then I could say this again, I love you. And then the next reaction would come up. And after a while, it was like a cleansing. I began to feel that I did love me. But it wasn't in a foolish way. It was a sense of that one is worthy of respect and love. That one has self-respect, in other words, or that when you get outside, when you get beyond just the kind of conditioning of your mind and the perceptions you have of yourself, when you've kind of let go of all that, then you find there's a natural kind of love there that's innate to us. So it's part of our very being, but we tend to get dismissed or smothered or overlaid with our negativity and our criticalness. Now then, it's also interesting to say with towards others, especially some people that bring up strong emotions of aversion. This is really hard work, because we do tend to. People that bring up strong aversion in our minds, oftentimes it's justified in a way. There's certain grounds for this, and we can be quite kind of convinced of our own rightness about it all, almost there's a kind of conceit or pride, not wanting to feeling that it's almost our duty to despise these people, and that to love them would be like betraying the truth, because these people, I mean, when you've got a self-righteous streak in you, you think these people should be punished because they've done bad things, and there's no way that that you should let them forget it, or let them off easily. And I think this is probably strong with men, because we have this kind of this judgmental streak, at least some of us do, where we can get very heavy-handed and very self-righteous. But observing this also with metta, and just this, the one's own kind of righteous feelings and one's own feeling of the sense of one's self view as being something that's true, and you're not going to let go of it. You with an attitude of metta, you're more willing to admit these things into consciousness, to observe them. You're more willing to let them admit them, so that you can accept them and see them, because they arise and they cease, they're impermanent. And this is a way of cleansing the mind, more and more kind of releasing, freeing your mind from its conditioning and from its kind of blockages, obstructions. So when we chant metta, chant so that the remember that they're not meant to be, they sound maybe superficial or sentimental even, or just nicey-nice, but it's actually pointing to an attitude that we need to develop, so that like all of the Buddhist teachings are not just, don't take them on just the superficial appearance of them, because they're quite profound. They're much, you know, words do have their limitations. You can only say so much, and that's it. And so don't give too much significance to the wording of the teachings as what's it pointing to as a way of developing mindfulness and a skillful means to deal with the conditioning of your mind and how to relate and respond to the experiences of life. How to make metta work for you, not just trying to, it's not like whitewashing, painting over something, and just trying to be sweet and nice about everything when underneath you're seething with rage and bitterness and disappointment. It's not that. There was a woman who went on a metta retreat a few years ago, and this metta retreat was the monk was doing this metta practice for about 10 days. And during this time, every night they had to send metta to all these different beings, and one, of course, was the mother. And so monk would say, "Now think of your mother, visualize your mother, and send her loving kindness. Think of all she's done for you, and all that she's, you know, sacrificed for you." And this woman, I guess, she had a pretty horrible mother, and so she'd just get angry, you know. She'd think of every time this came up, she'd just freeze into, you know, just with rage, because she felt she was supposed to spread loving kindness, but she didn't. But she, all she felt was rage, and when the perception of her mother came into her consciousness. Well, then that began to worry her, because she thought, there's something wrong with me, because I can't do this, you know. Everybody else seems to be doing it, but me. And so this was a great worry to her, because she felt somehow despairing, because she couldn't radiate loving kindness to her mother. Now, if you're trying to work through these difficulties, say, these kind of, if this had happened to you, what would you do? You know, can you just suppress your feelings and then spread this loving kindness outward? Or, you know, if you feel you've been, you're justified, or that there is this unresolved anger and rage, so then we can make a problem about we've got all this unresolved anger and rage and must go to a psychiatrist or a psychoanalyst to deal with it, which might help, I don't know. But also, one can have metta for one's own rage, so that you can admit it into your consciousness. And this is important when rage and bitterness and resentments do arise in your consciousness, don't be frightened by it. Just recognize it. That's probably a good thing. Just accept it. So loving kindness or metta is a way of accepting what maybe you're frightened of or don't like. Like the rage maybe you've always been holding down, or the bitterness that you've repressed. And then when it comes up into consciousness, then you've spent so much time resisting and rejecting it, ignoring it, that all you can do is feel frightened by it and hate yourself for having it. Or you can have metta for it, which is an attitude of accepting it for what it is. It's like this. And it's impermanent. It will cease. And you're, You're accepting it for what it is, for the way it feels. You're not saying it, you didn't justify it or analyze it. Just be willing to feel it. Be willing to accept it as a conscious experience. Be willing to feel it, and then you can let it go, and then you're resolving. There's resolution there. That you're letting things go. Those old karmic tendencies, when they arise, then you can let them go. If you have this. And so metta is an upaya or skillful means for an attitude of mind which helps you to deal with what you most dislike or are frightened of or most resistant to. So it's like patience, acceptance, willingness to let it be what it is. You have to remind yourself, and you're willing to feel it. Because it was, when you, don't be frightened of feeling these things, these emotions. But feeling them doesn't mean indulging in them, it means admitting them and willing to let them be what they are, and to be allowed conscious recognition for what they are, with this attitude of kind acceptance and patience with it, non-aversion, not adding aversion to it, but willing to accept the misery of it in the present, or the ugliness of it in the present. And then it ceases, it's anicca. So you're seeing the Dhamma of it. This is how to resolve, skillfully resolve these repressed, suppressed emotions, or some of these fears that tend to haunt us in our lives or pursue us wherever we go, until we learn how to resolve them. So I teach metta like this, and because I found it very helpful to myself in dealing with these kind of problems in my own life. And people that, you know, that do use it this way, began to, you know, feel that they begin to have more confidence in dealing with the pain or the anger or the rage or the discontentment or the bitterness that might have been repressed or held down in one's life, in one's mind. Then the more you free your mind from those tendencies, then it's much easier to do that in regards to external beings, as we reflect, as we contemplate, as we learn to let go of our own opinions and views, of our own positions. I think many of us learn to soften up a bit, to be a bit kinder than we used to. I'd say I'm much kinder than I used to be. I'll put up with a lot more than I used to. I used to be much more hard-line monk. And over the years, people used to be frightened of me because they'd see me, because I could get quite fierce and quite heavy. But contemplating that, you know, I see that a lot of that came out of my own fear. And, you know, I could see that the hard line was oftentimes the only way I knew how to deal with the situation. So I could get, you know, very domineering or very fixed and very scolding, because it was when you really looked into what was happening, you saw you were exasperated, or you felt threatened, or you wanted to you felt hurt by what somebody did, or you felt that you had to do this to set everyone straight. There was a strong sense of self-righteousness there. And so as one keeps learning from life, we most of us learn through our errors, don't we? We don't start doing things right. We usually start doing them all wrong, making a mess of it. But you keep learning from it, if you keep observing what works and what doesn't. And so one more, you see that you can trust people, that you don't have to dominate them. You don't have to, people are, they aren't expecting you to be kind of perfect and flawless, and that most of the monks and nuns are quite kind in themselves, and they're quite willing to accept weaknesses and faults in their senior monks and so forth. So you begin to have a sense of being at ease and trusting in a sangha where your life is very much shared with our spiritual goal, and it becomes much more pleasant, much more wonderful way to live because of that. Where the other tendency to want to having very fixed ideas and high standards of what should be, and trying to make everyone kind of fit into these high standards, and trying to force things and control them, was exhausting, and all one wanted to do was get out of it. I used to have a lot of problems of wanting to run away, wanting to run off to a cave. I used to wish, I'd read, when I first came to England, somebody gave me a book about UFOs. And there's beings in outer space who are watching us, and they come sometimes and kidnap people. And I remember thinking, I wish they'd come and kidnap me. Get me out of here. And I just disappear in the outer space. I've been so... Because the learning was, there's still this need, there's still this sense of duty, of having been responsible, of having to live up to high standards, having to all kind of noble things in themselves. But by carrying that burden on yourself, it was, you felt always this sense of being weighed down by what you thought people wanted of you, and your own sense of responsibility and dutifulness. So the secret is how to live one's life and be responsible without feeling that you are. And how to be able to do these things without making any problems about them. How to live our lives without making them complicated. And this is what, in what we're really moving towards in our own practice, what meditation does, or hopefully it will do for you, is able to open you up and to help you to deal with the complications of your karma, of your life, and the endless challenges that life brings us. Because it's always, you think you've just gotten over one crisis and one difficult thing, and then something else comes, and so you, Is there going to be any end to this? And then you think, it's fine, whatever. It's just part of the practice. It's just the path, Eightfold Path. Crisis, no crisis, success, failure, praise and blame, happiness and suffering. It's just keep going. Don't get overwhelmed by or want it to be otherwise. Just learn from what you get and even welcome. Embrace what life itself, and I'm willing to experience it, willing to feel it, and willing to investigate it and learn from it. So this is, so the Buddhist teaching isn't a teaching to get you out of things and get away so you don't have to feel or be hurt by anything. It's not a life for cowards or people who can't take it. The Buddha's teaching is a teaching that prepares you for all possible experiences, all contingencies. Admittedly, when in the early years I just wanted to get out, hide away in nice, quiet environments. Because I like tranquility and nature and I like being alone. I'm quite happy on my own. And then there's also fear and not wanting to get involved in complicated things, not having to be responsible for things. But life, somehow things happen and you find yourself being thrown into things. And so then I became aware that I shouldn't try to hold on to my ideas of what I wanted. I should learn to flow. And this is what's happened. Here I am. But the benefits of it are that one is able to grow up and to be able to face life in a much more courageous way. Than if I'd just tried to stay off and protect my peace, tranquil life, and refuse to get involved with anything, but just trying to control the environment. If I was forced to come back to the West after that, I'd probably fall apart in despair. If you get used to a certain type of environment, and that's like a hermetic practice. I remember some of the monks used to say now they couldn't practice in Bangkok. They'd say, you can't practice in Bangkok at all. So the only place you can practice is in the forest. So. And that seemed right. We all preferred practicing in the forest. None of us wanted to go and practice in Bangkok. But sometimes we had to go to Bangkok, especially Western monks. We always had to visa problems or things we had to do in Bangkok. So then you'd hear some of the Western monks saying, oh, I went to Bangkok and it just destroyed my practice. I was getting my practice together here in the forest, and then I went to Bangkok, and it was completely shattered, destroyed. Can't practice in Bangkok. And so I kept thinking about this. I think, did the Buddha say that Dhamma is dependent upon a place? Or is Buddha pointing to being free from dependencies on things? What is the Buddha, what his teachings about not being attached to things and not being, thinking that you have to have certain things in order to get enlightened. It's being free from all that kind of controlling and opinions and having opinions and views. So obviously, How do you practice in Bangkok then? Well, if you're expecting Bangkok to be like the forest, then you can't practice in it. But when you accept Bangkok for what it is, then the practice is just the same, isn't it? You're not idolizing, you're not saying, I can't practice here because it's not like practicing in the forest.